It was a famous Italian and amateur astronomer, Leonardo da Vinci, who once said that the discovery of a good wine is increasingly better for mankind than the discovery of a new star. Some would say that adage is as true now as it was in Leonardo's day. And one, albeit incidental, reason that we look forward to the Giro each year is the opportunity it affords to enjoy, indeed imbibe, one of Italy's great natural treasures. This year, as in 2020, the Cycling Podcast has gotten together with Divine Cellars of London to offer an enological homage to the Corsa Rosa. Chief Route Master, our viticultural Mauro Vegni, is once again Greg Andrews of Divine Cellars. I sat down with Greg last week to discuss our selections for this year and indulge our mutual passion for most things Italian and red, white, and even fizzy and pink. Greg, first of all, great to have you back for another year with the Cycling Podcast, Divine Cellars and Cycling Podcast, presenting the Giro dei Vini, the Giro of the wines of the Giro. And you and I have put our heads together and we've come up with another six bottles a case for this year's Giro. But first of all, I wanted to ask you, when you saw the Giro route for this year, what did you, from a wine point of view, and when you started thinking about having to select wines for that route, I mean, it's pretty good, wasn't it? I mean, you know, Puglia, Tuscany, Piedmont, you couldn't really hope for much better, could you?
Absolutely. But first of all, it's great to be back with the Cycling Podcast. And when I did look at the map, it was really exciting, actually, in terms of taking us into some different areas to where we went last year. Also sort of looking up north in sort of Friuli and around the northeast of Italy, there's a lot of good things going on in terms of wine up there. So, and the tour does focus a little bit up there and then through Tuscany, leaving us, you know, some very good wines to have a crack at, really. And I think the case we've put together, I like to think, sort of showcases that. I mean, we could do another dozen wines, you know. There's so much good wine, you know, through these areas. It was really good fun. I mean, sure, we're not in Sicily like we were last year, but you know, there are some really good wines on show, actually, and we can have a look. We'll sort of discuss now, that in further detail.
Now, Greg, your shop is in London in the UK, and obviously wine consumers in the UK are a lot better informed and a lot more, I suppose, sophisticated than they once were, maybe 20, 30 years ago. But when people think of Italian wine, they still think of Chianti, Barolo, maybe Valpolicella. But what are your current feelings, thoughts about the way wine in Italy is developing and the way sort of Italy has opened itself to a more international market and more international palates, I suppose, over the last 10, 20, 30 years?
I think you certainly still have the historical customers who embrace the sort of traditional Italy. For example, your Tuscan reds and your Nebbiolos and Barolos and Amarone. But I think what you're also starting to see is people wanting a sense of adventure. And I think Italy, with over 400 classified grape varieties and probably another further 400 that are unclassified, it's almost a sense of adventure, something to discover. You can always pull out something different. And I think certainly the younger consumers are quite excited by that. And in terms of some of the different styles that are coming out of Italy, in terms of some respects, in some areas, there are no rules, you know, in terms of, sure, with the regions of Tuscany and Piedmont, there are some restrictive DO rules. But then you go out sometimes outside of that, where some people are just creating some really fabulous table wines that push those boundaries, that do different things. And I think the consumers I've got, the younger consumer has an appetite for something different and almost that sense of adventure. So, you know, they're not afraid to get out. They want to drink sort of things like Schiava from Alto Adige. They want to drink sort of some different wines, whether they be natural or more traditional, but just things that haven't been on the radar previously. I think there's a greater appetite for people to want to try something new and different. And I think Italy has that phenomenal diversity that it offers people to say, hang on, you know, try something different. We've got something that's not just it's different, but it's just been under the radar here in the UK, and it's a really good opportunity to sort of go through and do different things.
And you mentioned young consumers there in the UK, Greg, but young winemakers in Italy, I mean, there's been a lot of coverage over the last 10 years or so about young people leaving Italy, a big exodus of young people from Italy. But then you also see a lot of young people getting into, well, craft breweries. There are a lot of craft breweries being set up by young Italians, but also winemaking. There are some pretty sort of dynamic and exciting Italian, young Italian winemakers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the producers we work with, Francesco, who produces the Cosimo Massini wines, he's a biodynamic farmer, and he's been making wine now 8 years. And his wines have sort of come on strength to strength, and he certainly embraces modern techniques and pushes those boundaries, like using a bit of carbonic maceration and things like that to create a softer, juicier wine that for a Tuscan producer is quite refreshing. It's very new ground and sort of sheds some different light. And a couple of the other guys we've got that we're working on are second generation of the family, where I think it's like a lot of children, they want to break the mould set by their parents and do something different. And these guys are producing some very innovative, fresh styles. For example, I think the last year we had Elisabetta Foradori's Teroldego. Now, last year her son took over the reins, and the style of the wines is far fresher and far more energetic, to a point where it's opened up to a totally different market, where, for lack of a better word, a lot of the hipsters, the younger drinkers, weren't really interested in drinking mum's old, more traditional style wine, which was phenomenal in itself. But he's come onto the scene and done something a lot fresher, put a wax seal on the wine, and it's a lot more progressive, and it sells out, you know. So I think exactly what you're saying, that younger generation who are coming through doing progressive things, I think has created a lot of excitement, a lot of good energy in the Italian wine scene, really.
We're talking about young winemakers. I think, Greg, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but the first wine that we're going to get to as we sort of tour around the Giro route now is the Iuli winery in Piedmont. And I don't think you knew this, Greg, but actually, I think the Giro d'Italia actually goes past the front door 115 kilometres into stage two. So we'll be looking out on the helicopter shots. But I think that is quite a young winemaker career, if I'm not mistaken. Is it Fabrizio Iuli? But we've picked Barbera, which is the classic sort of workhorse Piedmontese red. Tell us a little bit about that, Greg.
One of the big reasons for selecting, I mean, having met the guys sort of at a wine fair in London a couple of years ago, I was quite impressed with the approach and just sort of generosity of the wine, where some Barbera can be a little bit cumbersome and you sort of need to take time to get to reflect and get to know it, whereas I think the Umberta just struck me as a really accessible wine that offered some really generous flavours up front, but equally, it was really a pleasure to drink. And I thought, you know, with the I like the ethos behind them, the organic ethos, where they want to invest their time in producing better quality fruit, which of course is the building blocks to making a better wine. I mean, you can't make a good wine with bad fruit. And ultimately, the point where these guys are starting are giving the wine every chance to be as full and as joyous as possible, really. And I think, you know, their passion was very clear when I met them, in terms of I think I met he and his wife at the time, and they were very much, I was fortunate enough to taste the whole range there, and this very much is their entry level into the range, but it's still a delightful wine, and it was too good to miss out on this occasion. And it is coincidental that it's as close. I tried to pick wines that were relatively close to the Giro, but in this case, I think you're really pleased that we've got really close to the stage, actually. Really,
and you mentioned there, well, I don't know whether they class themselves as natural wine, or it's certainly organic. You and I had a conversation earlier, didn't we, about biodynamic versus organic versus natural wine. And I know you've got a lot in your shop that are organic and biodynamic. Can you just spell out the difference for us?
So in essence, I mean, the difference between organic and biodynamic is, I suppose I often view them as two distinct sets of growers, where the overlap is what you call natural winemakers, I suppose, who could be classified as both. But effectively, organic is where you're, I think most people are pretty familiar with the no chemical fertilizers, pesticides or herbicides, and effectively just using sort of natural, either natural alternatives. And what I mean by that is sort of organic alternatives, like, for example, using manure as a fertilizer, etc., using other alternatives. Whereas biodynamics is actually an agricultural system based on 24 different tenets laid out by German scientist Steiner back in 1924 that embrace sustainable agriculture. And a lot of it's based on traditional methods, harvesting and planting on the lunar cycle, a number of natural preparations that you could call those organic. But I think the big facet is biodynamics view the farm or the vineyard in this conversation as an ecosystem. So they like to allow wild herbs and grasses to grow between the vines on the premise that allowing insects to eat that foliage that keeps everything in check, and allowing wild birds and animals that then keep the insects in check. So it's all about a sustainable balance that they're operating within the winery. And I think very much so it's, some people say, oh, it's they're the same, but they're not, because in biodynamic viticulture you can use some non-organic preparations. Equally, organic viticulture, they don't go through the same level of preparation that you do in biodynamics either. So one of the tenets involves what they call creating a compost of local cow horns with manure, and then burying that in a corner of the vineyard to influence the microorganic balance of the soil. Now, without getting too spiritual or going into the whys and whatever, it's, you don't do that in organic or level of organics. You would just sort of spread the alternate fertilizer that you have available, i.e. cow manure or whatever. Whereas biodynamics is definitely a lot more local focused and sort of looking at sort of a more sustainable version of traditional agriculture. But either way, you don't do either if you don't prioritize better fruit or you want a better quality product, because in either organic or biodynamic, there's a lot more effort than conventional agriculture. And as a result, you're not going to put all of that effort to make something that's bland and uneventful without a signature. And I think one thing's for sure, both organic and biodynamic producers are hell-bent on having a recognisable signature with their wine. And I think taking that a sort of step further, a subset of that community would like to produce natural wines where effectively they're doing even less to the wine, where they're not filtering or fining it, or they're not adding any sulfur as a preservative at any point in the production. And that's a little more extreme and can be a little bit more volatile at times. Sometimes the results can be absolutely fantastic if all the parts are in place, but equally they're less stable. And I think a lot of the producers I've met over the years, you know, are slightly conservative when it comes to that approach. Just simply they want the wine to be they want to give the wine every chance to be as they intended it to be as possible. And that means adding a small amount of sulfur to the wine just to stabilize it, like the guys at Uli do. It's fantastic. It just helps them do that.
We talked about it earlier, didn't we, Greg? My sort of slight misgivings about some natural wines, and I used the word funky, which is a word that's, I guess, quite often used to describe natural wines. What does that mean? How would you define that? I mean, it's sort of a bit farmyardy, isn't it?
funky is certainly one of the words we get thrown in describing natural wines. Tasting like cider is another, and sort of smelling like a horse's barn is another. but you know, effectively, the intention of creating, the reason why people want to create a natural wine is they feel it shows a more distinct link to the area in which it's produced, or the terroir, and the smells, the aromas, and everything from the surrounds by that. Now, in some cases, because of the lack of, regulation, and the lack of use of some of the stabilizing methods, like a little bit of sulfur, the wines can be a little bit more volatile, and they can be a little bit more erratic. So, for example, you may taste they're very much a living thing. So you could taste the wine today and you could think it's rubbish, you could think it's really funky, and then 6 months later, that could evolve and take on a different profile. And in many cases, the producers, sometimes they want to embrace that, but equally some of them who understand the commercial aspect don't want anyone to taste the wine and think, oh, that's shocking, I'm never going to try that again. You know, they do mitigate some of those risks by using a tiny little bit of sulfur and just sort of making something a little bit more conventional, but stable is a better word to use. But we do have people who embrace that style and do come in and say, look, I want something, I want this, a light red wine with bags of acidity and volatility. And yeah, that's great. We can certainly help them. But I'd say sort of in the main, most people want to know they're drinking something that's healthier and being... had less manipulation is a good word to use, I think, you know. So, but yeah, it's a really interesting sort of sphere, and there's a lot of arguments and a lot of conjecture over who's right and who's wrong. But I think the reality is, as one natural producer once said to me, he said, "Who am I to tell you what's right or wrong? As long as you're enjoying what's in your glass, is the end result."
So, Greg, unfortunately, so that's stage two. We've got the Juli Barbera, and then we've got 6 more days until the next one. We're going to have to go all the way down the peninsula to the southernmost point of this year's Giro, and we're going to Puglia. And the next one we've got is the San Marzano. It's a Negro Amaro, isn't it?
Yes, the San Marzano. Fabulous wine. We actually, sort of going down to Puglia, we were almost spoiled for choice. You know, there are some fantastic varietals down that way that you just don't see anywhere else in the world. You know, things like Nero di Troia, Negramaro, you know, Primitivo, another one. You're almost spoilt for choice in terms of vibrant, full-bodied, juice-driven wines. And I think we did come across the San Marzano, and just, I think the quality, it's really a phenomenal value for the wine you're getting, really, and that screamed out to us, and it really is a fantastic benchmark example of Negramaro. You know, it's just, yeah, and it's been we've been stocking this wine for about 6 weeks, and it's just been, we've had some incredible feedback for it, so it was almost criminal not to put this in the selection. I think whilst, given we were talking about organic and biodynamic viticulture a couple of minutes ago, because of the lack of disease pressure down in the south of Italy, a lot of these vineyards are actually organic by the fact that they don't need to use herbicides or pesticides down there at all, just because of the strength of the climate that they're working in. And definitely, they don't need to use fertilizers either.
And the kind of climate, Greg, that lends itself to that is it's quite dry. It's not particularly humid.
Exactly. I mean, in terms of really dry conditions, loads of sunlight, and you know, effectively that ideal Mediterranean climate that you get, you know, through southern Europe, the south of France, Spain, Greece, all of those areas do lend itself to the production of these wonderful juice-driven wines that are just, have got, you know, yes, you've got some good tannins there as well, but there's just so much flavour jam-packed into these wines. It's, you know, it's fantastic. I mean, and certainly the Negramaro is a good example of that, I think. I think it really does lend itself to good, I suppose, good, really good drinking around the sort of £15 mark, to be fair, you know, in terms of... It's, and our experience is certainly we've seen customers vote with their feet and come back for this wine. It's been it's been fantastic. I mean, unfortunately, I've not managed to get down there myself, but, you know, it's definitely on the agenda, that's for sure. So very envious of those following the tour will be going through, that's for sure.
Still guessing on fueling, not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter, never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
Greg, before we get any further around Italy, I want you to tell us very quickly how you came to work in wine and what's your wine origin story in about three minutes.
My wine origin story, so aside from, I think a lot of people in my position, it probably goes back to university where I ended up working as a waiter in a reasonable restaurant in Brisbane in Australia. And that's kind of what, I mean, mum and dad always drank, always loved their wines, but when you started working as a waiter for quite a nice hotel in Brisbane, kind of fueled that a little bit further, and it became a massive hobby for me. And then when I arrived in the UK back in 98, I didn't want to wear the suit because I was working in sort of for Qantas Airways in their strategic planning area. Didn't want to wear the suit for a while, so I worked at Bluebird when it first opened.
Famous Conran restaurant?
Yes, the Terence Conran restaurants. I was there while John Turode was head chef as well, so it was good fun. The Australian invasion vibe in a big way. But it did really open my eyes to the wines of, you know, wines in Europe, and just started to fuel that passion where I invested quite a few courses myself and, you know, close to a couple hundred vineyard visits, you know, over the next 10 years, where in 2009, whilst I was working as a software consultant, I started selling wines on a market stall and started up a wine club where I was selling to friends and doing tastings while I still had a full-time job. And then 2 years later, opened a shop, Divine Cellars, just around the corner from where I live here in Clapham. And, you know, and we also grew that to opening a wine bar, and then, you know, just over time, we then condensed that. So we've just got the one operation now in Clapham North. But, you know, it's been a hell of a lot of hard work, but equally it doesn't feel like hard work. You know, it doesn't, it's almost consuming. And the more you realise the more you start to learn and immerse yourself in wine, the more you realise you don't know.
Well, that's the thing with wine, isn't it? That it's such a vast subject. And as soon as people, I mean, this is much more the case for you than it is for me, but as soon as people think you know a little bit about wine, they expect you to know absolutely everything. And, you know, I've got friends who work in the wine industry and, you know, they're winemakers. But if you ask them about even quite a well-known region, you ask them about Amarone or something, they have no idea because they simply, people can't get around to tasting, you know, even a tiny fraction of the wines that there are.
Well, even in Italy, you know, like one of the members of a team, you know, Luciana, who works with me, she used to be a sommelier. She grew up in Piedmont working in a family restaurant. So, and she freely admits she knows a lot about Tuscany, but she knows a hell of a lot more about Friuli and Piedmont and sort of the northeast of Italy and Sicily. And she's like, I only know a little bit. And she knows a phenomenal amount, but it's almost just, you know, as I said before, there's over 800 varietals, 400 that are categorized in Italy. And to get to the bottom of, you know, in terms of the bottom of that, you just never will. You just keep finding more and more. And that's what I love about wine. There's always something. You'll never learn everything. You'll never know everything. And that's a great thing, because you can always sort of always be captivated and learn something new. And I think, you know, for me, wine's about, and I say this every tasting we do, wine's about being inclusive and sharing that knowledge to whoever's willing to listen, you know. And you know, equally, it's there to be celebrated. It's, you know, it's there to be enjoyed.
Well, you said, Greg, that it all started for you in a restaurant, so serving food. The next wine on the list sounds like a food because we've got the Pecorino, which I must admit, when I first saw that on an Italian wine list many years ago, that confused me slightly. But again, this one, we've done pretty well here, Greg. This one's only 15 kilometers off the route of stage 9 through Abruzzo.
So we're doing better than last year's tour. We've got a few wines really almost on the route, haven't we? The Pecorino Giulio in Abruzzo, it's fantastic. I think this is an absolutely phenomenal seafood wine. You know, really fresh and, you know, really vibrant. I remember when I first tried this wine, I had it with fish and chips and it was absolutely perfect because it's got that acidity, that brightness that just cuts through the sort of the fats of something like a fish and chips. It's really, really brilliant. Equally, having it with things like cheese with a little bit of salinity will also work incredibly well. It, you know, goat's cheese or something like that. You know, even a dried Pecorino would also go reasonably well with it, actually. But the reality is, in terms of as a wine, it's about freshness and really a vibrancy that when you're sitting down in the restaurant or you're eating of seafood, I think this really, really comes into the equation as just a lovely, really dry, vivacious wine, actually.
And Greg, I'm terribly unprepared here because I remember last year I looked this up and I found out why it was called Pecorino. Pecorino, of course, sort of means little sheep, and that obviously applies to the cheese. And I think there was quite a good story about, or a good theory about why the grape variety was called Pecorino.
But I have heard several theories of this, but the one that seems to have sort of gained the most credibility, shall we say, is the fact that the bunch of grapes almost resembles a woolly sheep, you know, in terms of the sheep's coat.
That's it.
Yeah, and in terms of really sort of a really tight bunch of grapes in terms of very little space between the berries, and almost looks like a, you know, the wool on a really sort of woolly sheep is where it came from. I mean, no sheep were harmed in the production in this wine, absolutely. But it's not, I mean, they may have sheep grazing in between the vines to keep the foliage down, but these guys, they're organic producers as well. So, you know, in terms of, they're not biodynamic, but definitely that story, I believe, is true in terms of when the grape was initially named, it was named because of that. That's definitely true. And it's one of those, it's a nice story though. I can see where they came up with it.
Well, next, Greg, we're moving up the peninsula and we're moving to, well, where I sort of first fell in love with Italian wine in Tuscany, but we're going to Montalcino on the Giro, and we haven't got a Brunello or a Rosso di Montalcino. We've committed sacrilege, really, by doing that. But on stage 12, just off the route, we've got the Cosimo Maria Mazzini, and you know, you talked about all your vineyard visits, and I know you've got a personal relationship with these guys.
Absolutely, it would have been fantastic to do a Montalcino, but we did
blown the budget, wouldn't it, Greg?
I was about to say we'd be drinking some pretty ropey stuff outside if we'd come on that. I think so. We would have had to sort of come up with a balance that worked, and I think there are a couple of wines definitely in the frame. But my good friend Francesco, I wanted to sort of show. I mean, San Miniato is actually famous for truffles. And when you go into the town, there's even a truffle restaurant where he has.
Are they black truffles, those ones?
Yes,
Greg?
Black. They predominantly black truffles, and the truffle festival is through October and the first 2 weeks of November. And, you know, it's, it really lends itself to that sort of style of food. And I remember Francesco himself, he works biodynamically, so that, you know, he invests a lot of time in creating the best quality fruit. And this particular wine is pure Sangiovese, where it's pressed, goes into concrete tanks, and he does that not because he has these fantastic old concrete tanks in the winery. Yes, that helps, but it's more to preserve the freshness of the wine. You know, he's made the decision that with Nicole, freshness is the main thing he wanted to. And I think in terms of, for me, this is sort of really his benchmark Sangiovese at its purest form. It's got a lovely weight to it. Whatever, in terms of whether you're eating a sort of pizza or any pork dishes or any sort of medium weight meat, it's fantastic. You know, equally, if you just want to have a couple glasses of wine and, you know, it works well with that. It's not going to beat you over the head. And, you know, because he's biodynamic and using a minimal amount of additives, some will have you believe it won't give you a hangover. But rest assured, you can certainly drink enough of it to do that. But it's a wonderful, wonderful part of the area, probably an hour and a half outside of Pisa. You know, so, you know, really is it, you know, it's hilly, it's undulating area, whereas his vineyards are in almost a microclimate where there's a small valley. The temperatures don't get blazingly hot. So again, that's helping the fruit with its acidity, and they're never over the top or too clunky, which is another reason why it was very easy to select Cosimo Masini as the wine for Tuscany, really. Even though we did try our very best to get a Montalcino in there, that's for sure.
I said, Greg, that I sort of first fell in love with Italian wine in Tuscany, and especially that region, sort of Montalcino region. But, you talked about how sort of multi-layered wine is, and, you know, the reasons to get interested in wine. But one thing with me is that I find it much easier to get really passionate and interested and excited about wines when I can also have a mental image of the place. And I was talking to someone recently about, you're from Australia, and I've sort of veered away from Australian wines over the years, you know, as fantastic as they are, simply because I've never been to Australia, and it doesn't have that extra dimension for me where it takes me somewhere because I can't visualize.
I think you've hit the nail on the head for me in terms of one of the reasons why I love wine so much, in terms of it's the one thing, I mean, food does as well, but it can transport you. It can take you away. It can captivate you and take you away from whatever drudge you might be experiencing.
It's like a cheap airfare, isn't it?
Exactly. And interestingly, you say that. We've got a number of customers who, certainly through January, in terms of it was pretty bleak and they weren't able to travel, they made up their own European getaway. Whereas we, you know, so through the month, I had one couple, and through the month of January, every Friday and Saturday was a different theme. So, and that one week was Spain, next week was Tenerife, next week was Sicily, you know, next week was Tuscany. And it was really quite fun trying to match the things that they were eating and doing. And it really did, I suppose, entertain them in terms of that little project, where they could go ahead and sort of do different things and eat and drink different things that would actually make them remember their holidays and do things like that. So you're exactly right. And even now, when we're talking about that, I can still remember sitting in the villa at Cosimo Masini, and basically outside the tasting room, looking down into the vineyards, where the first thing you overlook is his vegetable patch, where he grows the vegetables that feed his team that come in and do the harvest, who are generally working volunteers or they're all students in wine. And yeah, that's fantastic. It just almost transports you back there, where you, especially when you smell the wine, it almost like you smell the air, you can smell the herbs and the things local to that vineyard. And that's why I get so excited.
So next, Greg, we go from, well, one extreme to another, sort of a deep, juicy Tuscan red, to we're going up to the Prosecco region, stage 14. We've done well here again, the Adami Prosecco. It's again maybe 3 or 4 kilometers off the route this time of stage 14, and but this is a you told me this is a slightly different Prosecco, and I was intrigued by this Col Fondo, and the Col Fondo points to the fact that it's a slightly different Prosecco made with a sort of champagne-type method, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this is not your normal Prosecco, and for two reasons. One, the Col Fondo method, and secondly, my wife actually likes it. She actually hates most other Prosecco. And partly the reason is it is made in a very similar fashion to champagne and cava, where It spends an extended period of time on the lees. Now, without getting too technical, but the lees are the dead yeasts that aid the fermentation of the wine. But by letting them stay on the lees, it adds an extra level of complexity, almost slightly textural creaminess to it. You know, like you'll often hear of Muscadet Soleil. Well, that wine is basically the same thing. The wine has been fermented and aged on the lees, so it develops that extra dimension. Now, this certainly does, goes into the bottle with the lees as well, so it ferments in the bottle, which is why we've nicknamed it the Dirty Prosecco, because it is unfiltered, it is, but it adds a phenomenal dimension to the wine. Now, some people will then ask, oh, because of that sediment or the lees, is it a pet nat? Well, no, it's made as a wine previously and then goes into bottle. And then certainly for this particular producer, I think it sort of reflects a different level of minerality. It enhances the citrus aspect. And yes, it is bone dry. It really is, you know, a lot drier and a lot fresher than a lot of other Prosecco. Because when you see extra dry on a Prosecco in terms of it's not dry as what you might get in a cava or a champagne. And I think this dimension really does add something to it, and really is I'm expecting a few people to get quite a surprise, because it is cloudy, it has got a little bit of texture, but it really is a fabulous bottle of wine, and definitely I think will change a lot of people's perception of what a Prosecco can do, you know, in terms of it can actually sort of offer a lot more enjoyment, really.
Greg, just sort of standing back and observing the incredible meteoric rise of Prosecco, the kind of Prosecco rampage of the last 20, 25 years. I mean, it leaves me, I've sort of been shocked by it as well, because I knew Prosecco. I actually worked on a vineyard in Prosecco very briefly about 20 odd years ago. And back then, no one in certainly the UK would have heard of Prosecco. And then all of a sudden, 10 years later, it was sort of overtaking champagne, became ubiquitous. And, you know, all sorts of reasons for that, right down to sort of the industrialization of that area of Italy and how sort of efficient they were with production and stuff. But there are still elements of it that I don't understand how this has happened. And I've spoken to people in Italy about it, and they sometimes give good answers and sometimes they sort of shrug their shoulders as well. Why has it happened? How has it happened? And what do you think of it?
For me, I think it's very much a number of elements that just resulted in the perfect storm. I think, you know, the British certainly, I mean, speaking about, I said, the wine drinking public in the Western world, I think is probably a good, nice, broad focus. Is, I think they were lacking. You had champagne, which was seen as a special event drink or something very elitist that you're only going to do on certain occasions, but people still wanted something fun, fizzy, and a little bit more something that they could drink on its own as an aperitif. And sure, you could find different wines and things like that, but Cava had the same opportunity and didn't capitalize on it. But I think the ability for them to upscale the volume in Prosecco production was able to fuel that demand. And also, I think the focus to get this into the supermarkets, into the younger drinker, then just sort of perpetuated itself over the years, really, where it really did become an acceptable aperitif, and I think, or just an acceptable drink in the pub, and I think it really did sort of explode in that way, and I think Britain is definitely the largest Prosecco market, you know, Britain. I mean, the US is probably a bigger market by volume, but in terms of percentage of saturation in the public, I think Britain is hard to beat in terms of that fascination and with Prosecco, which is a good thing. And I think Cremant certainly wasn't coordinated like Prosecco. You know, like, for example, with, sure, France makes a lot of good Cremant, but the fact is you have a Cremant de Loire, you have a Cremant de Alsace, and it's all quite disparate. Whereas in, I think, the Italian, you know, certainly in Prosecco and Veneto, they got behind the product and actually got it placed in the, you know, in the supermarkets and really drove the market that way. But the only other similar thing I've ever seen is Malbec from Argentina, in terms of being a, you know, those two wines. There's no other domination I can think about it where I've seen such a rapid growth, where they just developed this sudden mainstream popularity that really was, you know, a beast, really.
I've searched in vain for a book on it to explain, or a documentary to explain sort of how it's happened from A to Z, and haven't really found one to date.
It's quite interesting. I mean, talking to some of the producers I know, you do hear some stories of white wines making their way up the highway into Prosecco, because they can't, just in order to meet the demand, the immense demand they had for Prosecco, really. So it's using sort of other varietals in there, but, you know, as opposed to Glera, which, you know, is, I think, you know, we'll only see, you know, time will tell us whether that sort of it will stay forever. But I think it's just a phenomenal, I still think it's one of the most phenomenal brand, I suppose, product positioning that we've ever seen, really. And I almost don't think it was conscious. I think it just was the perfect storm.
Yeah, one thing, Greg, that has even occurred to me is that, you know, it was a name that sounded quintessentially Italian, but was easy enough for people to pronounce and easily recognisable. Whereas, you know, that might not have been the case with something else. It was Franciacorta, or, you know, I mean, it can even come down to things like that.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, Franciacorta as well was price prohibitive. So you're almost back in the Champagne elitism area. And, you know, Franciacorta is a wonderful wine in itself. I mean, there's, you know, but it is at Champagne price point, and I think, and it almost was because of that price barrier, it's seen for most people as something, oh, it's a special event wine, or it's a celebratory wine. Whereas I think Prosecco was kind of, people wanted something that they could drink every week, you know, and that was there just wasn't anything there at the races, really, you know, that was as enjoyable and as well, drinking culture change, where people wanted to be able to have a few glasses as opposed to just one. And I think because it is less fizzy, it's easier to drink in that fashion, and became popular as well.
That's stage 14. Stage 15, we've done even better, because we've got, again, it's the race is going almost past the front door of the Ronco del Niemis winery, I think it's called, in Friuli, 86 kilometers into that stage 15, go past the front door in a little place called San Giovanni al Natisone.
Yes, so this particular producer is Luciana recommended I look at these guys. They're actually, you know, they make some truly fabulous wines, and I think, you know, they're an amazing producer, where they have their own vineyards that they use for some of their higher end wines. In this case, they work with some other organic producers in the area, and they do buy in the Chardonnay fruit, where they want to make something pure, something very, you know, lean and fresh and revitalizing, really. And I think that was one of the reasons why I was thinking, okay, do we look at this, or do we possibly look at a Pinot Gris, or Pinot Grigio, I should say. And I think certainly the strength of this particular wine, you know, just shouted out to me. I mean, we've priced the wine for us is retailing at £19.50. The rest of their stable generally retails around £30 to £40. So they really are a very high caliber producer. And, you know, it just shouted out to us that these guys really know what they're doing. And to have something of this quality there would be, it'd just be too good an opportunity to miss out, really.
We talked about wine trends in, well, in the UK, Prosecco, Greg, but Chardonnay, the sort of the fall of Chardonnay, or Chardonnay being gazumped by Sauvignon Blanc, that's an interesting one that I've certainly observed over the last 10, 15 years. How did that happen? And is it because there was a time 15 years ago when you would go into a British supermarket and every white wine, or 8 out of 10 white wines, were Chardonnay?
Well, I think it's sort of, the wine trade, or certainly sort of wine consumers, it always evolves, because I think people always want something different. And I think certainly in the case, people were bored, your big gloopy Australian Chardonnays, for example, or American Chardonnays, people weren't enjoying, and they weren't sort of, didn't feel as though you could finish work on a Friday and sort of tuck into a glass and it would refresh you and uplift you the way in which Sauvignon Blanc, or even, you know, Pinot Grigio, or even a glass of Prosecco would do. And I think over time that the consumer has become a little more educated and wanted something different. And Sauvignon Blanc was a bit of perfect storm. You know, they were there at the right place in New Zealand, with such a vibrant, accessible product at a reasonable price point, very much like Prosecco was. And the market jumped on it. And now what we're starting to see is, I'm starting to see a lot of consumers say, I want a dry, fresh white wine, but I don't want Sauvignon Blanc. And I think that's where we're seeing fresher styles of, you know, sort of like dry Rieslings come back in the frame, Albarino, you know, Pecorino, and even things like sort of an unoaked or a very modestly oaked Chardonnay, which is what we're looking at here, come back into the frame, and people are starting to enjoy something with it that shows a bit of sort of minerality, you know, sort of almost like some where you start to see something that's really refreshing, a bit more uplifting, come through. And I think Chardonnay has so many different variations, and I'm pleased that people are starting to see that, and certainly producers are generally making a fresher, more accessible style. And I think we probably won't see it go back to what it was, but I think we will start to see a lot more people drink a bit more Chardonnay than they used to.
Well, Greg, that concludes our journey, but I'm going to ask you to think about something. We're going to move on just as we wrap up, but just think about this, and while we do, your dream three Italian wines. I'm going to ask you for those in a minute, but just start thinking about them. But I just was curious, Greg, obviously we hope that people are going to enjoy consuming these wines that we've selected for them, but generally wine consumption in the pandemic, what are your hot takes a year in? How's it been for you guys?
I certainly, from my observation of how consumers have changed in what they're drinking and how much they're drinking, you know, certainly, I think initially people drank more. You know, people were at home, they were bored, and they, you know, people were certainly sort of drinking higher volumes than what they're drinking now. But I think as well what happened is people learnt to cook at home again, and people actually realised that 20, 30 pound bottle of wine that they, or $20, $30 bottle of wine that they were getting in a restaurant or a pub, you could get for a third of the price, you know, and people were upgrading and investing more in themselves and buying a lot, being a bit more adventurous with what they were buying as well. So, you know, we found people coming to us, certainly when the shop opened. I mean, people, yes, our home delivery business initially was fantastic and it was very strong. Then as things started to open up in sort of July and August, people were climbing the walls and would dive back in the shop and almost, you know, enjoy the conversation, that level of engagement where they wanted to talk to you and understand a bit more. And as a result, they'd be a bit more adventurous with some of the wines they were choosing. For example, you know, being able to think grapes, you know, varieties like Timorasso and Pecorino, Malvasia. People were sort of opening their eyes to these type of wines and wanted to drink more of them. And I think definitely we saw people become more adventurous. And I think, as well with various price rises in the likes of Burgundy, for example, people now tuning into Nebbiolo. You know, that Burgundy drinker now knows he's not going to get a decent bottle of Burgundy for under 30 quid. Oh, I'll look at this Pinot Nero from Tuscany, or look at from Alto Adige, or look at something different that's going to give him that freshness and that similar flavour, but at a slightly kinder price point as well. But I do think people have become certainly more adventurous and definitely investing more in themselves, really. And I think that above all else is a positive thing, where I think getting the consumer out of the supermarket aisle and actually, for us, being able to offer that service where people can come in as a shop and actually really sort of enjoy the experience of looking around and talking about what they're going to match with. And I think the standard question we get asked, or the standard question my staff ask when you come into the shop is, you know, do you want a white or red? It's like, what are you eating tonight? And we'll give them some options from that. And a lot of our customers are conditioned to that and will come in and say, look, I'm cooking this ragu, a duck ragu tonight. What am I going to have with that? And things like that. And that's been a really enjoyable side to the things. I mean, yes, it's been a little bit depressing and a few, but equally, I think that people have learnt to cook again at home and enjoying that gastronomic adventure. Almost as we said before, allowing themselves to be transported out of whatever drudgery they're in right then and there.
Well, we better not talk about or start talking about Italian food, because then we will be here for
all
night.
We will be there all night.
Greg, last thing, money's no object. We're not, we're not constrained in any way now. 3 bottles of Italian wine. I mean, you can name producers if you want, if not just sort of regions and roughly types. But
I mean, I'm glad you've asked me this question on the spot. Otherwise, I could deliberate on this for days. So, because there's a hell of a lot of good kit out there, and you can always, the more, again, like we said before, the more you think about it, the more you go, oh no, I could have this, I could have this. But certainly off the cuff, I would say. There's one wine from a producer called Borgo di Tio in Collio. He makes an absolutely sensational Malvasia that is barrel aged in large oak barrels. Very, very subtle influence over the wine, and you just get this lovely sort of complex flavour coming through, where you get hints of stone fruit, but it has a almost like a stone fruit marmalade almost, where you get a nice little tang to it, and just very, really easy to match with foods, and sort of anything like from a roast chicken type of thing to a mushroom risotto, it would certainly live in that space for sure. So
you've thrown me by going for a white from Friuli. In, well, we're gonna put that on the third step of the podium.
Yeah. So in terms of, I'm gonna give you 3 different wines, and sort of that's number one. Second of all, is actually a wine from a Sicilian wine from our case last year.
This is sacrilegious. We've named 2 wines, and none of them, you haven't named one Barolo or Barbaresco or Brunello.
So the Sicilian wine I was thinking was the reverse of Nero d'Avola we had last year. And again, as soon as I drank that wine, it just made me think of a big steak Fiorentina. You know, really sort of almost gutsy, robust flavours that would sort of live up to that tannin and so forth. So an Amarone, you'd certainly be in the frame on something like that. But I think in this case, that's kind of why I would lean that direction. And, a well-made Nero d'Avola for me, I suppose, it's almost sunshine in a bottle. You get a lot of warmth and heat from that, and you do get a bit of minerality off there, obviously because of Etna and so forth. But yeah, lovely wine. And then finally,
come on, you've got to go blow the budget, Greg. Go for a Biondi Santi Brunello or something like that.
A Brunello is a great call, actually. Or what I'm thinking is something I had recently, the Roccolo Grassi Valpolicella Rapasso. You know, really, almost like a baby Amarone, you know, in terms of it. But it's just, sometimes Amarone, you've got to wait for it to settle down. And this was a sort of relatively younger vintage. But it was delicious. I mean, we put it this way, we're at about the £45 mark anyway. But it's just really sort of ripe fruits, almost like a vibrant cherry berry conserve almost. You know, it was just really intense flavour. Very much made in a similar style to Amarone, but just not as dusty, if you know what I mean, and not quite so tannic. Oh, it was a beautiful wine. I mean, but again, as I said, I could not probably name another 12 wines that it's just sort of off the cuff. But the Roccolo Grassi for me, really rich, but equally still has a vein of freshness that just makes you want to come back for another glass. And I suppose that's probably why I didn't say, well, with Barolo, I've had some good Barolo, but when someone once said to me, when is Barolo too old to drink? So in terms of, because I think, I must admit, on Barolo, we've seen a sort of evolution where I think the new wave of Barolo producers are finally producing something that's a little bit more lively and a bit more energetic, where you can drink it within 5 years as opposed to having to wait 20 years, which is a good thing, actually.
We haven't got that long.
No,
we've got that long. Greg, will you be watching the Giro d'Italia?
I will be this year, because hopefully I'll have a little bit more time than what I had last year, that's for sure. So, yeah, no, definitely. You'll probably ridicule me on this. It's usually on Eurosport. Is probably the best place to watch it. I will be, actually. I mean, I do generally watch the highlights from the Tour de France. That's probably the main one. I probably, with the Vuelta and the likes of that, I'll always check the website. But in terms of, I think this year I will get amongst the Giro, actually. Definitely. Definitely.
Well, Greg, we'll catch up with you again to discuss our Tour de France wines and our Vuelta wines. But in the meantime, cheers. Salute. And
salute.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dan. Brilliant.
For details of how to order our Giro d'Italia Giro Vagando selection, and indeed our 2021 Tour de France and Vuelta selections, log on to thecyclingpodcast.com. Or order directly from Divine Cellars at the website address included in the show notes to this episode. Please drink responsibly at all times, and indeed during the Giro. Si bella non ci innamora, non me facile.